We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, it's an honor, of course, to be joined by the one and only Speaker Newt Gingrich, who is out with yet another book called this one's called Defeating Big Government Socialism, Saving America's Future. Mr. Speaker, thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Now, you're prolific, and I'm curious, this book in particular, what motivated you to take up this book at this moment in American history?
I think two things. One, that the disaster which the Biden administration would turn into would be written off as a performance problem, when in fact it's a fundamental ideological problem that the things they believe in do not work. And it was very important for us to wage the 22 and 24 campaigns around this basic idea that there are ideas that work and there are ideas that fail, and that the patterns of big government socialism and the woke left are simply wrong. And I was very struck. Margaret Thatcher, Prime Minister Thatcher, had said, first you win the argument, then you win the vote. And starting as opposition leader in 1975, she had set out to destroy socialism as an acceptable vision for Great Britain. And she succeeded so decisively that in 40 years, no left-wing leader has become Prime Minister of Great Britain. It's been an amazing achievement. We continue to make the same mistakes, from Lyndon Johnson to Jimmy Carter to Barack Obama to Joe Biden, and they continue to have disastrous outcomes in practical, everyday human terms. And I think that it's important for us to, for once and for all, win the argument that big government socialism doesn't work. The second reason for writing the book is that we needed a series of positive steps forward. At a time of a bitter partisan opposition, there are at least 25 issues on which you can assemble 70 or 80% of the American people, and you can create an American majority, not a Republican majority, but an American majority. And so my goal with this book, in part, was to lay out for people the idea that we find the big things we agree on, and we agree to work on those big things, we can actually have a successful, implementable governing program. And that's the reason I wrote the book.
That's a really good segue into one question I wanted to ask. Just right away when I saw this book, the topic of the book, the title of the book, it reminded me of the Tea Party years and of that 2012 campaign when Republicans were hammering this message that about big government socialism and the threat of it. And I'm curious, as a sort of looking back now with 10 years, I can't believe it's been that long, in the rearview mirror, did 4 more years of Barack Obama really take us to that place? Where do we stand on the spectrum of big government socialism, and were those 4 subsequent years of Obama's leadership really responsible for that thrust to where we are now?
Well, I think that Obama was certainly a dramatically more radical person than his personality. And I think that he had been around people who represented the very hardest left parts of American society. And he basically was in favor. I mean, he was very clever about hiding it, and he was very clever about pretending to be a normal American. But in fact, he was a genuine radical. And he promoted people and encouraged people who were genuine radicals. He dramatically accelerated racial division in America, which was tragic. Here was a first African-American president, proof you could succeed in America. Obama could have been the person who really brought us together beyond racism. But instead, every incident that could be magnified as black versus white, he magnified it, including places where clearly he was just historically wrong. He took a position that the facts didn't hold up. At the same time, he did everything he could to expand government. He did everything he could to undermine American energy security. I wrote a book called Gasoline at $2.50 a Gallon and got attacked by Obama because it was impossible. And of course, with the fracking revolution and with the discovery of the huge reserves we were finding around the country, I knew that it was not only possible, it was very likely. But all that occurred despite what he was doing and against what he believed in. So what happened was the Tea Party movement rebelled both against Obama, but also against what they saw as a failed Republican leadership. And despite the great victory in the House in 2010, which was an amazing victory, they won 63 seats. We'd won 54 in 1994 in becoming the first House Republican majority in 40 years. But they actually surpassed us, but they weren't able to forge it into an effective tool. And the result was people were very dissatisfied. We tend to forget that when Donald Trump announced for president, 63% of the Republicans disliked their Washington leadership. So there was a huge, latent majority in the Republican Party looking for somebody who had never been in office and who wasn't tainted by being part of what they saw as a failed system.
Hmm.
I think that Trump's victory then so galvanized the left. I'm actually working on a concept that intersectionality, the whole concept, which is I think a weird concept, but the whole concept that everybody who is on the outs is connected to everybody who's on the outs. So if you are gay and you feel like you are part of a minority, you are automatically identified with people who feel that they are ethnically a minority, who are automatically connected to people who are ideologically in the minority. And they form this intersectionality coalition in a way I had never dreamed of, so that all of them vote for each other automatically because their combined opponent is normal everyday America. And so the result is you have this emerging coalition of people who are all misfits from traditional America. At the same time, their goal, and this is one of the things that took me a long time to sort through, their goal is to fundamentally change America. So we keep trying to reinterpret them as though they are traditional, normal political figures. But it's actually, and I'm thinking about writing a piece on Lincoln versus Lenin. You know, Lincoln says in his simplest formulation at Gettysburg that we are for government of the people, by the people, and for the people. Well, Lenin and the Bolsheviks were exactly the opposite. They despised the people. They were determined to take over Russia and destroy all of the traditional institutions, including down to the level of peasant villages, in order to then invent and grow this new Soviet man, which would somehow lead to a utopian perfectionism. And they were just astonishingly ruthless in doing it. Well, if you look at the teachers' union commitment to teaching 7-year-old white girls that they're inferior because of their skin color, which is pure racism, or teaching third graders that they should be spending time thinking about what transgender relations ought to be like, or that we should not have mathematics because mathematics involves hard answers of yes and no, and therefore some people will get the wrong answer and they'll feel bad. So we should basically abolish and invent a new emotional mathematics that allows for multiple answers. So when you go through these things, if you dealt with them one by one, you would think they were crazy. But they are, in fact, a collective understanding of creating an alternative America and using the power of government to do it. It's really the most striking time since the Civil War in terms of an assault by an elite determined to fundamentally change every American, whether they want to or not.
There was so much talk back in the 90s about Republicans just endlessly pursuing an endless stream of Clinton controversies. And right now you have the, bipartisan committee, because if you're considering Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger bipartisan, then we have a problem. You have the January 6th Select Committee playing out intentionally on primetime. And I'm wondering, socialism, as we think of it, often people get caught up in this idea that it's about an economic takeover, and it's that, but it also has other implications. It has cultural implications. And I was thinking this week about something you said, I want to say it was back in January, about potential law breaking on the behalf of Democrats and I guess Republicans that have also decided to take up this mantle and investigate the Trump administration around January 6th. And I'm curious, what you've thought. Have you seen, let's say, the hearings of the last month as an accelerant?
Well, it was actually the January 6th committee which led me to Lenin and the October Revolution of 1917 and the nature of the Bolsheviks. And that's because Liz Cheney, who's the most anti-Trump, anti-Republican member of the committee, much more aggressively anti-Republican than any of the Democrats. Cheney is essentially a Stalinist, and she has put together a show trial. They have a simple test. They have 1,000 videotaped interviews, 25,000 documents, from which they are carefully selecting the pieces they want in order for their show trial to have the right dramatic moments. And they're not going to release all the material, because all the material would undercut their drama. They have a narrative that they're determined to sell us on, and they're going to browbeat us into watching it. And they have allies in the major networks who have given them an amazing amount of free time for what is essentially literally a show trial. This is not a congressional hearing. It is not a classic American intervention. It has none of the attributes of the Bill of Rights. You don't have an ability to identify and to cross-examine anybody. It is so much worse than anything that Joe McCarthy did in the great hearings about communism in the 1950s, that it is astonishing. And because the media has now all become basically fellow travelers, think of the New York Times as Pravda and the Washington Post as Izvestia, and you kind of have a flavor of where they're going. They're all going to cover and protect and report as though it was serious stuff what is in fact completely made up, hand-selected storyline that has no attribute of a traditional American adversarial search for truth.
So I definitely consider my incessant skepticism both a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing in journalism for sure, but as I've watched all of these MyPillow ads over the years, I have just been plagued by the question, are these as good as the commercials say they are? I've always wondered this, and when the fine folks over at MyPillow were kind enough to send me some of their products, I was really pleasantly surprised. These things are great, and right now they're having a BOGO extravaganza, so you can get buy one, get one free price on the MyPillow bed sheets as low as $59.98, the Elegance MyPillows as low as $49.98, and that six-piece towel sets. Those are my favorite. Those are included in the BOGO extravaganza. Also, the Roll and Go Anywhere MyPillows for $29.98, and so much more. Those six-piece towel sets are made with cotton grown here in the United States. Other towels feel good but don't absorb, or they absorb but they don't feel good. Every MyPillow towel is made from proprietary technology that makes them highly absorbent and soft to the touch. I can confirm that. It's absolutely true. Like I said, these are my favorites. They have no lotiony feel either. Every set comes with 2 bath towels, 2 hand towels, and 2 washcloths. So you got everything you need. They're available in a variety of colors and sizes, and they are machine washable and come with a 60-day money-back guarantee and a 1-year limited warranty. Those roll and go anywhere MyPillows. You can use them on your couch, your recliner, or in your car. They're versatile enough to take on vacation or really anywhere you go. They're also available in multiple colors and patterns and machine washable and dryable for all you parents. That's the most important part. They come with a 10-year warranty and a 60-day money-back guarantee as well. So as you can see, it's a buy one, get one extravaganza over at mypillow.com/federalist. Bed sheets and MyPillows are just the tip of the iceberg. Find the full list of BOGO offers by visiting mypillow.com/federalist or call 800-794-8429. Stock up with buy one, get one free savings today and get Mike's book free with any purchase. MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. MyPillow.com/Federalist.
And do you think they're continuing to put themselves at risk if Republicans take over by the way they've handled the last month of hearings, the intensification, I would say? Are they putting themselves even at greater risk when Republicans inevitably investigate their conduct?
Well, I think they're at risk of a lot of things. And I think that they have distorted information. They've lied about information. I think they have use the power of subpoena in ways that are totally wrong. I think that they've cost an immense amount of money to innocent people who have to go hire lawyers just to survive the experience. So I don't know quite how to explain it. I have never seen anything in the American tradition which resembles this. And that's why I think it's much closer to In fact, I ran across recently a description of the first show trial in Russia, which is about 1921. And I used it and tweeted about it and did a column about it because it is so exactly parallel to what they are currently doing that it's a little scary.
Interesting. And another point that you made earlier is that part of the ascent of Donald Trump, it came at a time when, or it was happening in this context of people being deeply, deeply frustrated with leadership in Washington. And, you know, I feel like the Republican Party has stood pretty firm when it comes to the January 6th hearing in particular. Kevin McCarthy has been pretty firm on this, at least now. Whether that was always the case is a different question. But if you were to grade Kevin McCarthy and Mitch McConnell, are there things you would say they're doing right or they're doing wrong that stand out most to you?
Well, I think in McCarthy's case, he has had a strategic approach to recruiting women and minorities and to raising the resources. He's far and away the most successful House Republican leader at raising money ever in history. And, you know, when they were supposed to lose 25 seats in 2020, they actually gained 15. That's a swing of 40 from the expectation. Every single seat they picked up was either a woman or a minority or both. And he is deliberately, methodically, you know, broadening the base of the Republican Party. We just won a special election on the border in South Texas with a Mexican-born American who came to this country, married a border patrolman. She's going to be a remarkable figure. So I think in that sense, McCarthy is creating a modern party. He has appointed 7 working groups to develop ideas and to be able to have this fall sort of the equivalent of a commitment to America, his version of what we did with the contract. He is very methodical. If he has a weakness, he doesn't have a flair for fighting, and he doesn't have a flair for picking the right moment to keep the other side on off balance and keep him on defense. And I think part of that is dealing with Pelosi, who is the first real dictator of the House in American history, and has wielded power with a very narrow majority in a way that I wouldn't have thought possible. He also, I think, recognizes he has a news media that is totally hostile. I mean, one of the things I think they ought to be doing is offering a resolution to release to the public all of the 1,000 interviews and all of the 25,000 documents, and let the Democrats explain why they favor secrecy and why they're afraid to trust the American people. I think he also had in Liz Cheney, who after all was, a very senior member of the leadership. I think she was the fourth ranking or the third ranking member of the leadership. And, and she is in essence totally opposed to everything that Kevin's trying to do. Mm-hmm. He had in that sense a much, I never had any defector at that level. And Liz Cheney's an extraordinarily smart, determined person amazingly destructive.
And there was some frustration that bubbled up to the surface, both on Capitol Hill and a little bit in the media, when Senator Rick Scott of Florida released his own agenda. The McConnell camp kind of saw that as an affront to them. And Rick Scott sort of openly talked about dissatisfaction with leadership on the Senate side. Mitch McConnell has been in a leadership position on the Senate side for the GOP for quite a while. Do you think, do you sympathize with Rick Scott's sort of take on that? Do you think McConnell is still the right leader for Republicans in the upper chamber?
Well, I think McConnell's got to prove that. Look, McConnell has been extraordinarily effective at managing the Senate. You have to remember that all three of these Supreme Court justices that conservatives are proud of got through because of Mitch McConnell. The first one because he blocked the effort to appoint the current attorney general and kept a vacancy open to be filled. He and Trump, even though they deeply dislike each other, collaborated to get more judges approved than any time in history for the first term of a president. He's done a pretty good job of blocking Schumer and maximizing the problems for the Democrats in a 50-50 Senate. And he's a very effective fundraiser, far and away the most successful fundraiser in the history of the Senate, which gives him real resources to help elect people. On the other hand, he's not a great strategist. He doesn't pretend to be. And I think that frustrates somebody like Scott, who came out of a corporate background and as a CEO automatically asked, what is the strategy? What are we trying to implement? And I think he finds it very hard to pin McConnell down in that sense.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And another thing I wanted to ask about is this report in Roll Call. They surveyed, it was not a scientific survey, but they surveyed leadership. They surveyed top staffers on the Hill. They got most responses from people on the House side. And basically, top staffers were saying that Congress isn't working. And, it's very, the incentives to cooperate across the aisle are so low that nobody does it, thus nothing gets done. And, from a Madisonian perspective, there's maybe a silver lining to that. But I guess from your vantage point, having, lived through all of this, experienced what it was like in a prior era and actually reformed the way that congressional offices are staffed and function and all of that, what's your take on how things are happening, just the machinations of Congress right now?
Well, part of the reason I wrote Defeating Big Government Socialism is that I think we actually have very, very big reforms that have to be implemented. We're not going to survive as a free country in a world that's inhabited by dictatorships like China, China, Iran, Russia, Saudi Arabia, Venezuela. There are a lot of players out there that are dangerous and that are quite happy to gang up on us if they can. And I think that we've been through a period really starting in 1941 that we defined the planet, we dominated the planet, and we made it remarkably safe for individual travel, for commerce, and for most countries. As our power has diminished, the world has grown much more dangerous. And we have only the Russian invasion of Ukraine is only a taste of what's coming. And I think that we have to confront that gridlock, which in some ways is at least keeps you sort of safe. If you have systems of failure, gridlock is not good enough. If we don't finish fixing our education system, where I think we have actually begun to turn the corner and begun to see really dramatic change, if we don't get these great bureaucracies under control, I mean, you know, the Justice Department totally out of control. It's astonishingly corrupt. You can't have groups that are offering a bounty for finding conservative justices, and the FBI and the Justice Department does nothing to protect them. That's an act of pure political corruption. And it's typical of what we're up against right now. So I think there are, it's more than just beating the left and then getting to the current system staying in place. You have to actually beat the left and have a series of positive reforms, as a result of which you get to a more functional and more effective America, capable of both being very productive and prosperous and safe, and also capable of raising several generations of citizens who believe in freedom.
If you're like me, you might be dreading looking at your 401k or IRA account balance lately. You're not alone, and we're hearing all of the experts say there's just no place to hide. But that's simply not true. The truth is you can build a financial bunker that grows and protects your money even during the scariest economic times. The Bank on Yourself Retirement Plan alternative lets you escape the financial carnage and has never had a losing year in over 160 years. Whether you've been investing for years or you're just starting out, now is the time to bypass Wall Street and bank on yourself. Bank on Yourself lets you reach your financial goals and dreams without taking any unnecessary risks. You get guaranteed predictable growth and retirement income with no luck, skill, or guesswork needed. The strategy also lets you take a tax-free retirement income, which protects you from the coming tax tsunami. Unlike a government-controlled 401k, IRA, or similar plan, you control the money in your plan, not the government. You can use the money for any purpose with no questions asked without interrupting the growth of your savings. This is the strategy famous businesses like McDonald's have used when no banker would lend them a dime, and almost anyone can do it. Plus, there's no volatility. Your plan doesn't go backward when the markets tumble. Both your principal and growth are protected. You can get a free report with all the details of how adding Bank on Yourself to your financial plan can help you take back control of your money. Just go to bankonyourself.com/Federalist. That's bankonyourself.com/Federalist.
Writing a book like this one on big government socialism, defeating big government socialism and saving America's future seems to me such an overwhelming task. And the book walks through solutions. And to me, it seems, again, it's overwhelming because this is so deeply ingrained in our government now. And I remember, you know, like most Republican voters remember, all of the pledges to repeal and replace Obamacare, but certainly to repeal it. And, you know, that leads to the distrust, of course, that people have in not just Republican leadership, but the Republican Party and the political system in general. And the reason that was so, I mean, there are many reasons that was so difficult for Republicans, including extensive lobbying and just the lack of, I think, consensus on what a better solution for it is, the political incentives not to do anything. It's a lot of this stuff, a lot of the things that you write about and a lot of the problems are so deeply ingrained in our system of government at this point. It feels very hard to pull them out, root and branch. Were you optimistic? Because you know you sound optimistic, but it was it hard for you to muster that optimism as you wrote this book, or did you find yourself actually getting more optimistic as you outlined potential solutions and concrete steps?
Well, I mean, I think I wrote the book because I'm an optimist. I first got to work with Ronald Reagan in 1974. And I ran for Congress in 74 and lost in the middle of Watergate. And then I ran again in 76 and I lost with Jimmy Carter at the head of the Democratic ticket in Georgia. And I finally won in 78. And then I helped the Reagan campaign. And the first Capital Steps event that unlocked sort of a contract with America was Reagan in 80, not what we did in 94. And I saw the power of offering the American people a program that was positive, large, visionary, and doable. And he did that. I mean, you look at how much he turned around the country. It's in the fact that he set out to defeat the Soviet Union and it disappeared in 1991 without firing a shot. It's one of the great strategic victories in history. And I realized, and we came back, we did the same thing with the contract in 94. We found a set of issues. And again, I emphasize an American majority. We did a contract with America. Reagan had been an FDR Democrat as late as 1948. He had made commercials for Hubert Humphrey and for President Truman. And so he always thought of himself as a citizen who was registered as a Republican. But he would always say, my fellow Republicans and all of the independents and Democrats who should agree with us. And he constantly was expanding the base of the party. Well, we did the same thing. We didn't have a contract with conservatives or a contract with Republicans. We had a contract with America. And we offered a series of ideas. Welfare reform was very popular, as it would be again today. Balancing the budget was very popular, as it would be again today. Cutting taxes was popular. And so we had a contract made up of things where we averaged 63 Democrats voting with us on each item of the contract in the House in 1995, because they would go back home and the popular will had shifted and people wanted them to vote for it. And I think that a Republican Party which thinks like an American majority and which develops a series of issues at the grassroots so that the focus is not negotiating in Washington, the focus is educating America, I think that you then drag along a substantial part of the Democratic Party, or they get annihilated in 2024. And we had in Bill Clinton somebody who was smart enough to know that. So he had a huge fight in the White House in the summer of 95. And all of his liberal staff said, you got to fight these people. And Clinton said, if I do what you want, I'm going to get defeated. Mm. And so he broke with them. Now, I think Biden will, in fact, not be able to break with them because they're much, much stronger today. They're much nastier, and he's much weaker than Bill Clinton. But the fact is that if we follow through on things the American people believe in, if we're Lincoln Republicans in the sense that we focus on the people, I think that we will either pass an enormous amount in 23-24 or and having the Democrats veto it, et cetera, we will set the stage for an astonishing annihilation of the Democratic Party in 24.
You know, rounding this conversation out, I'm thinking of what has been dubbed the new right by the media. And I'm thinking about particularly a bill that Senator Romney has proposed, which is allegedly budget neutral and provides monthly payments. It sort of takes what was a tax credit. It eliminates some marriage penalties, smooths out the system, but then provides monthly payments to parents, generous monthly payments to parents who make over $10,000 of income a year. And I do see Republicans seeming to flirt with some of these ideas more and more. You know, if we're going to have an entitlement program, if we're going to have a welfare state, it should be tweaked to sort of produce conservative ends. And I wonder if you've seen this playing out, if you think it's a threat to the goal of defeating big government socialism and what you make of its ascent on the right.
Well, I think that people have to look at second and third order effects. You know, this is not a new game. Daniel Patrick Moynihan, as a domestic advisor to Richard Nixon, got him to go down this road back in about 1969, and it crashed and burned. The fact is that I think what you want is to have a real heavy emphasis on work, and you want to focus on cutting taxes and encouraging people to have the resources in their own pocket that they get to make the decisions, not the government.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And one final point, as we seek to defeat big government socialism here at home, we are also facing an incredible enemy in China, or an incredible, I should say, an incredible uphill battle in our back and forth with China to maintain our position as the leader of the free world and the leader of at least sort of stability across the world. And Senator Rubio has made a good point in recent days about how the fight in Ukraine and the resources that we've sent there has created in his mind a distraction, that's good for China because they see us pouring all of our resources into Ukraine and they see Putin continuing to fight it out. And what that does is, you know, it sort of deflects attention from them to Europe. And I'm curious what you think about that argument. Is that valid? Is there something we can do to address criticism like that? Where do you see that this in the context of China?
Well, I think, first of all, if we were a serious country, we have more than enough resources. And if we overhauled the Pentagon, which is a bureaucratic mess, we have more than enough resources currently being wasted that we can comfortably help the Ukrainians and contain the Chinese if we're willing to do it. I think that's a matter of American willpower. So it's not like we have a static pie. And if we give a slice to Ukraine, we don't have a slice left for China. I would say second, and I wrote a book along with Claire Christensen a couple of years ago called Trump versus China, which is still very relevant and which does have an entire chapter entitled It Isn't China's Fault. That goes through things like our education system and just says, you know, you can't blame the Chinese for all the things we're doing stupidly. We are weakening ourselves far more than the Chinese are weakening us. But having said that, one of the hidden things people are not paying attention to, India passes China probably next year as the largest country in the world. In about two more years, the Chinese population clearly starts to decline and starts to decline at a very dramatic rate. The side effect, this is why people always have to think about second and third and fourth order effects. The side effect of the one-child policy is that you have an age pyramid that is inverted. You're going to have millions and millions more senior citizens than you are young people in China. And the result is going to be that the Chinese capacity to be competitive is going to start shrinking very rapidly. Now, this may lead them to an aggressive adventurism be out of desperation, because they probably have 10 or at the most 15 years of really being competitive before the demographics just hammer them. And by the end of the century, China will be will have dropped from 1.3 billion down to around 700 million. And in fact, because we continue to have immigration and we continue to be the most successful Western industrial country, we will be proportionally closer to the Chinese in size at the end of the century, because we'll keep growing as they shrink, and we'll keep growing with younger people. So I'm not automatically pessimistic. I think that we've seen most of their neighbors begin to organize against them, They seem to have a knack, much like the rise of the Wilhelmine Germans in the late 19th century. They just irritate everyone. and they also, a lot of their deals are really so one-sided that a lot of these small countries are realizing that they basically bankrupted their country and are now, the Chinese are now like the nasty banker who won't work with them. So I think that we shouldn't automatically be defeatist. They're a serious opponent. They're smart, and they are capable of considerable achievements. But I would say that they're not They're probably not as close to us in capability as the Soviets were in the late 70s. And of course, after that, we just pulled away and the Soviets collapsed. And I think if we get our act together again, we'll pull away again.
Such helpful perspective. As always, Speaker Newt Gingrich, author of the new book, Defeating Big Government Socialism, Saving America's Future. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
You've been listening to another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. We'll be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray. Reason, and then it faded away.